and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Lara Zabaris, a food freedom psychologist and eating disorder recovery coach. She combines a background in psychology and training in nutrition, intuitive eating, and eating disorders to help her clients heal their relationship with food and body image. Her 20s and 30s were riddled with food anxieties and disordered eating, so finding food freedom was truly life-changing. She now runs a coaching program and offers online courses to help clients find health without obsession and the freedom and joy of eating again. It was such a pleasure to talk to Lara about her experience and how that has shaped her journey into eating disorder recovery coaching. It was really interesting to explore the normalization of disordered eating, particularly in situations such as pregnancy and both pre-pregnancy and post-pregnancy, and then also thinking about getting married and other stages of life, and using as an excuse purely for quote-unquote wellness, and that disguising things like orthorexia.
Lara, it's so lovely to have you on the podcast. I'm really glad that we connected, because I think I was following you, but it wasn't coming up on my Instagram, I'm going to be honest. You know, it's very naughty with the algorithms and stuff, and then Craig suggested that I follow you, and I was like, I already do, and I absolutely love your profile and the videos that you put on, so thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just so happy to be here today and really appreciate getting asked to be here, and I've been following you for a long time as well, so I've seen your posts.
Oh, amazing. This is the funny thing, when you when I meet someone that, you know, like has been following you for a while, I think you often forget about like the fact that people see your posts, or when I have listeners of the podcast, I'm like, wow, you probably know me better than my best friends. Which is always funny. But yeah, thank you so much for joining me. For the listeners, did you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure, yeah. So I am food freedom psychologist, I'm an eating disorder recovery coach, and I basically help women go from feeling totally out of control around food to feeling much more in charge and confident around food and happier in their bodies.
Amazing. Yeah,
in a nutshell.
In a very small nutshell. Yeah, and it's always funny when I ask people to introduce themselves and they're like, where do I even start? But how did you get into the work that you do now?
Oh, it's a long story, a really long story. So I think the main answer to that is lived experience. So I would say I would spend the vast majority of my adult life with a very negative relationship with food, and sort of all stages of disordered eating and also diagnosed eating disorders as well. So from about 16 to late 30s, that long, with a kind of on off, like sometimes just sort of slightly disordered eating and sometimes actually the extremes of actual eating disorders. And it was only really when I discovered food freedom and intuitive eating and that, that I got to a much calmer, peaceful place with food. And that's when I decided to retrain doing what I'm doing today. So I've always been a psychologist. I trained as a psychologist. I did psychology at university and built a career in that, and then in my late 30s retrained as a nutrition and health coach. I did intuitive eating and eating disorder recovery practitioner training as well, and I've combined that all together to now do what I do.
Amazing. And I think that element of lived experience is invaluable, really, isn't it? Because it's I think when people talk about eating disorders, it's often difficult to maybe understand the complexities of it. And obviously with your psychology background, that's amazing as well, because you get the brain and the complexities of the brain, but equally with your own lived experience, I think that brings an element of empathy that is so important when people are in recovery.
Yeah, you're right. Because I think it's really hard to understand. Like when people talk about, let's say something like binge eating, because I think people use the word binge in day to day. So people with a quote unquote normal relationship or food with food will say something like, oh, I binged or I overate. But they don't really understand what it's like to be literally taken over and then have a binge in the way that people with binge eating disorder or bulimia do. So it does make a difference, I think, having that lived experience and that empathy and understanding exactly what clients are going through.
Yeah, but I think you've touched on a really interesting point, and it's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, is, you know, the language that we use around things like binge eating and stuff. You know, people will often say, oh, I had a binge this weekend, and you're like, oh, you know, for me, I'm like, oh god, you know, is everything okay? And they're like, oh yeah, like I had a really big meal, and or I, you know, had loads of food that I wouldn't normally eat, and things like that. And I think that obviously that is not a binge eating disorder in the same way as that sort of like lack of control and then the guilt and shame and things that comes after. Absolutely. But the normalization of behaviors like that is quite scary. And I think, you know, I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday, and that the normalization of disordered behaviors with both food and exercise are becoming so much more common. And it is quite scary that we are losing touch with having such a, I don't want to use the word normal, because what is normal, but kind of just like a relationship with food that just almost what it should be naturally. I think we're very much coming out of touch with that, because disordered eating is becoming so normal.
Exactly. And I think this relates to a lot of things in psychology, where like words like anxiety or depression or what I said, binging, is being used in everyday language without really understanding what it's like to be depressed or to have anxiety or to have binging eating disorders. So terminology actually, I think, is everything really when we're understanding what people are going through, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that is such a good example in terms of like, oh, I'm feeling really anxious today, or, you know, oh god, they're being so psychotic, or things like that. Like, we do use it so flippantly. And I don't know, I wonder how we kind of stop that, or what we do about it, because I think they have become terms that kind of are just generally used in society that people don't even really think about when they're saying them. And, you know, I will often say to people, kind of, you know, don't want to be a negative Nancy here, but you shouldn't really be using that word, or you shouldn't be using that word, because, you know, people are actually suffering with those mental health conditions, and you're using them in very much the wrong context. And then people get all like uppity, and they're like, oh, for God's sake, the word police and what have you. But it's very kind of degrading, I think, to use those words when people have that experience and it's so consuming of their life.
Yeah, totally. Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to talk to you a bit to start with about your own personal experience. And you mentioned there that you, you know, you've had quite a journey with eating disorders and disordered eating. So without me saying again, can you give me it in a nutshell? Would you like to explain a little bit about what your experience has been?
Yeah, so I think for me, it probably all kicked off around the age of sort of 15, 16. And I basically made a decision then that I wanted to lose weight. And I think I often reflect on it, like, why did I think that? And I think it was probably a variety of reasons. I know I'd had some comments about my body. I was always a very, very, very tall child, way taller than all my contemporaries until I was about probably about 14 or 15, and then people caught up with me. So I was always aware that I was bigger than people, but really just taller than people. And then, so comments about my body, which had been freely given from maybe about the age of 8 or 9, people always commenting on how big I was, which probably they just meant that I was tall. But so I had that in my mind. And then combined with that, a lot of the women around me were dieting. My mum had been on lots of diets. My aunts, people always talking about, they were on things like Weight Watchers and low fat and all the fads that were happening in the sort of 90s and early 2000s. So I decided I was going to go on a diet. And I just, you know, I followed some things that I pulled out of a magazine, started eating less. And then I did lose weight, and then I started getting some really good positive comments from people, and people saying things like, oh, you're looking really good at the moment. And then what happened over a period of probably about 8 years, from about 16 to about 24, I was basically either trying to restrict and restrict a lot, which then would turn into me eventually binging and, you know, going from that extreme pendulum swing from trying to eat very little to not being able to control myself around food to having a huge binge, which then at some point, and I can't really remember when it was, but at some point in that period of time in my late teens, I discovered bulimia and how to purge. And I know it took me a while to realize that that was what it was. So I was like, oh gosh, I think I am bulimic. And it's funny, again, when I look back on it, those period of 8 years, I think bulimia was a coping mechanism for me. So it, when I look back, it was in periods of like extreme stress. I say extreme stress, but you know, during my A-levels, when I left home and I moved to London, I sort of was finding my feet in a big city and starting a new job. And so the stressful period of time was when bulimia was most evident. But within that, if I wasn't, you know, using that as a coping mechanism, then I was either trying to lose weight or I was binging. And it took me to about 24, actually, funnily enough, when I met my boyfriend, who's now my husband, and I realized he was the first person I ever opened up to about bulimia, because it had kept it a secret. No one knew what was going on. It was like literally no one had any idea. And I eventually opened it up to Alex, and then went to go and seek help, and I saw an eating disorder psychologist and also a nutritionist. Actually, funny enough, the nutritionist was probably the most helpful, because he literally taught me I relearned how to eat, like what was quote unquote, I say normal in inverted commas, like what was a normal amount to eat. So he helped me sort of reconnect with hunger and fullness, and he was very much about all foods fit. So kind of nothing is off limits, and that was really helpful for me. And then, so I would say I was in recovery then, and obviously it took a few months / probably about a year to be fully recovered. And then I had this period of time where at the time I was very much thinking that I was in full recovery and totally recovered from all my eating disorder behaviors. But now again, also in hindsight, I can see that it was probably quasi recovery, because I was still restricting, probably more mentally restricting. So I was still limiting what I was eating, even though I had this sort of all foods fit approach, and I still ate cake and biscuits and crisps happily, but I was quite restricted about it. And then later, so then I had kids in my early 30s, and then it was after children, and there's huge pressure for women when you have babies to get your body back and bounce back, and you hear everyone saying things like 9 months up, 9 months down. And then after my youngest, who's now 9, after she was born, I felt this just enormous pressure to get my body back, quote unquote. And I knew then that I didn't want to get sucked into a diet, because I was very aware that dieting had sort of fueled my experience of bulimia. So I was like, right, I'm not going to diet. I'm going to do this really sensibly. But then I really got sucked into wellness culture, and I ended up probably being even more restricted than I ever had before, because I was now doing it for my quote unquote health. So I was cutting out gluten, dairy, soy, you know, watching all these influencers and basically listening to all their advice about here is a way to eat, but it's for your health. And I sort of fell into being orthorexic, and I was extremely restrictive for maybe about 2 or 3 years. And I was doing a sort of a 30-day cleanse every few months, which was, you know, also had an impact on my social life, because then I wasn't going out, because I had to eat very in a very strict, restricted way for these 30 days. And even when I wasn't in one of these cleanses, I was still very, quote unquote, careful about what I was eating. And then I had this huge wake up call when my daughter was maybe about four, I reckon, where she basically said to me one day, "Well, Mummy, why aren't you having pancakes with the rest of us?" Because I used to make these disgusting protein pancakes on the weekend while my family would eat delicious pancakes. And I just had this huge, like, oh my God, what am I doing to my kids? Where Xanthi has seen me for the last sort of 3 years, I guess, at that time, being really restricted, not eating the same as the rest of the family, avoiding certain foods, certainly not eating the quote unquote fun foods on the weekends. And I was like, I suddenly realized, I was like, gosh, that's how it started for me, is like seeing women around me being obsessed about what they look like and dieting. And obviously I was doing it in a different guise. So for me, it was all about my health, quote unquote. And that's it. That was it. I was just like, right, I can't do this anymore. And it's funny because I've been through obviously seeing a psychologist and everything the previous time. This time I launched into reading tons of books, and I read all the like the Christy Harrison and the Intuitive Eating book and everything to do with food freedom, and sort of read stories like Megan Crabb's story about her experience with eating disorders. And it was just, I was suddenly like, right, so everything needs to change. And that was it. That's what set me on the path to then doing all my retraining and wanting to work with people to help them in their recovery. That was quite a long story.
Oh, no, I mean, you've literally just, what was that? You said late 30s, so that must be like 20 plus years. So that's, a concise.
Yes, exactly. Overview, yeah, exactly. 20 right. Years and 7 minutes or whatever that was.
You probably saw me, I hope you didn't mind me writing as we were going, because there were just so many things that I wanted to pick back up on. But I think, firstly, I just want to say that, you know, I'm so glad that you had that moment of like, no, this isn't happening anymore. And, you know, I want to, whether it was for your daughter or for yourself, whatever, I think often, and I spoke about this in a podcast the other day, you know, it's really frustrating when you're in an eating disorder to hear somebody say, you just kind of have to have that moment, and something clicks and you're like, yeah, but like, I'm doing all this hard work and the things, and it's really frustrating. But then when you get that moment, it's such a kind of eye opening thing of like, holy shit, like I can't do this anymore. Like something's got to change. So I'm going to go through some questions, based on what you said. So I'm going to do it in like the order that you mentioned. Okay. It. But, in terms of the bulimia, I think one thing I find really interesting to hear people talk about is obviously like the behaviors involved in bulimia, whether it's self-induced vomiting, laxatives, diuretics, whatever purging behavior, it's not the most nice thing to be experiencing. Mm-mm. But you keep going back to it. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, from your perspective, what was it about those behaviors or the bulimia in general that meant that you kept going back?
This is such a good question, because you're absolutely right. There's nothing about it that is pleasant. And also, I mean, you know, some of the sort of light bulb moments that I was having that encouraged me, not only obviously meeting my now husband, but I remember going to see a dentist, actually. And the dentist said, do you eat lots of lemons? Like, they were so sort of confused by what they were seeing in my mouth. And obviously transpired that the bulimia was impacting my teeth, and he could see the effect on my teeth. And again, so that like little light bulb moments that were happening to me, thinking, gosh, I need to do something. And then I had a callus on my hand from, you know, from the purging. So yeah, you're right. It's not pleasant. It's not nice, whether you're vomiting or using laxatives, and I'm mainly vomited, but I also use laxatives as well. And I know that those years of bulimia still impact my body today. I have like, you know, I definitely impacted my digestive system by abusing it for that many years. So it's not nice. But there's something about it. And I think, again, because I've done therapy and I've kind of really looked at what was going on in that period of time, I think that I never really learned as a teenager good coping mechanisms. I just didn't have them. And food became something that I could control and cope. And I think that I tried to control food, but actually food ended up controlling me. I didn't have the whatever it was that I needed to just not eat. I ended up doing the restricting, binging. And I think because I was feeling that out of control feeling when I was binging, and it was often a planned binge.
Mm.
Then discovering the purging element, there's something about, you know, I now know you get a bit of a dopamine hit. There's something about the relief of the release that makes you go back for more. So when you're having a stressful day at work, or you've had an argument with someone, or things aren't going so well, rather than any other coping mechanisms that maybe I use now, I just didn't have that toolkit. So, you know, I'd have a stressful day at work, I'd come home, I'd stop off at the corner shop, buy some food, go home, have a binge and a purge, and then I'd feel better. So there's something about the release, the relief of the release that makes you feel good, which seems so, for someone who's never experienced bulimia, that just seems so wild because of what you're doing. It's like, how can that behavior make you feel good? But there's something about it, the binge and the purge, that releases something, makes you feel good and empty. There's something about it. I don't know if that answers your question, but
it does massively. And I think from a I personally don't have experience of bulimia, but from, I guess, an eating disorder perspective, and you know, I mean this in the most empathetic way, it allows you to eat without the consequences of eating. And so I can understand why it is something that people go back to, because at the end of the day, if your main focus, you know, is your body and the way that you look, and you don't want to gain weight because that feels like the worst thing in the world, to be able to eat but to not have the consequences of eating, or eating that amount of food that you are eating, it almost, you know, from a completely irrational perspective, does make sense. But one thing I wanted to, and also just say as well, I, from the dentistry perspective, I'm on a massive push at the moment. I'm actually having a meeting with a dentist tomorrow, because I think that they could be a practitioner that could be absolutely incredible in early intervention.
100%.
I mean, it probably wouldn't be early intervention, but like you said, your bulimia went on for years without you telling anybody. If you'd have gone for the dentist appointment and they were like, oh, this actually looks like signs of bulimia, it may have changed something.
And I may have gone sooner, perhaps.
Yeah, if somebody kind of has called you out on it in the nicest kind of way. I don't know whether you will be able to answer this, but one thing that I found interesting that you said is, often when we talk about binging, we talk about that lack of control and that sort of people go into almost like a trance and they don't realize what they're doing. But from your perspective, it sounds like it was planned. And I don't know whether, from experience of working with clients, is that something you've seen in terms of bulimia tends to be planned, binge eating disorder isn't, or am I just kind of...
I don't know, because I would say that not every binge was planned.
Okay.
But because I was restricting as well, this all sounds so counterintuitive, doesn't it? But I was restricting, so I had no quote-unquote bad binge foods in the house.
Yeah.
So if I wanted a binge, I'd have to go out and buy the foods in order to binge. And I think also, this is going to sound a bit gross, but when you are bulimic, you know the foods that you need to eat to help purge easier.
Yeah.
So then you have to sort of plan it a little bit if you know that that's what you're going to do. Whereas, and I have obviously period of my disordered eating where I wasn't yet bulimic, so I was binging. And I think maybe it depends on what food you have access to and where you are and, you know, what's available in terms of what actually happens in terms of the binge or the binge and then purge.
And so you mentioned also the feeling of emptiness, which I can completely relate to, because I think at the depth of my anorexia, that, you know, that feeling of emptiness was the biggest high and something I was always craving. But did that then become very difficult, even if you didn't binge, to then sit with food in your body? Because you, I guess my question is, like, how did you cope then if you had a bit of food in you rather than a binge amount of food? Did you have to purge that as well because of that difficulty and feeling?
This is when my bulimia got really bad, actually, just towards the end before I went and sought help, is that that's what I struggled with. I struggled with any feeling of what I now realise is just normal fullness. It's like tummy satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
But I started to really struggle with any kind of fullness at all. So if we went for a meal, for example, just like a normal meal out at a restaurant, then I would have to purge afterwards. And obviously that introduces a whole host of complications. And it's not nice, because then that's when it really starts to consume you, because you're not comfortable with sort of any feeling, actually, any feeling of fullness in your tummy. And that, and a lot of the work afterwards was sort of reconnecting with my appetite and learning to be okay with that sensation of sort of medium fullness rather than over fullness.
Yeah. And how did you start to become comfortable with that? Because that's definitely something I've found through my own recovery of, you know, just sitting with that kind of satiated feeling. It felt very uncomfortable, which for other people would be, you know, I always think it's funny if we go to, I don't know, like out for a roast or something, and people will describe that like warm, cozy feeling of fullness, and they're like, oh, I feel so, you know, after Christmas dinner or whatever, it's like, oh, I feel so like cozy and warm, and I'm sat there like, this is the worst feeling in the world, how can anybody enjoy this? So how did you start to kind of normalize that feeling after a meal?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. And I think the biggest thing for me was to stop restricting, because I was doing so much. So it was so much the extreme of like either restricting or binging. And so, and this was where the nutritionist was so helpful, was like learning to eat small, regular portions through the day. So like, he was like, well, it's not even if it's a, it doesn't need to be a meal, it can just be a small snack, like an apple and some peanut butter. And so in fact, funnily enough, breakfast, eating breakfast was the biggest game changer to me, because I generally wasn't eating breakfast. So and one of the things that I used to binge on was peanut butter and jam on toast. And so his recommendation was, have peanut butter and jam on toast every morning for breakfast, just one slice. And it really was almost like life changing, because having that small amount of food early in the day and then having regular small amounts of food. And for me, I mean, it was a lot about, you know, let's learn how much you need to eat to keep you satisfied throughout the day. So his recommendation was like eating every sort of 3 to 4 hours, keep it small. And so for me, I guess it was not restricting so that I never got overly hungry, which was really key, because it was over hunger that stimulated a binge. But then also, I don't know, I guess that helps regulate the blood sugar levels. I mean, stuff that I now do with clients. I was thinking at the time, it was for me learning how to feel that small amount of fullness, you know, a piece of toast or a small lunch, you know, lunchtime, whatever it was, salad or whatever I was eating at the time, and to feel okay with that small amount of fullness. And I guess that was the start, really. But it took time. It really took time. I would say probably about a year for me of, and I guess this would be something that I would say to other people, is like, bulimia doesn't just disappear overnight. Yeah, I started seeking help and there were lots of things that I was doing, but I would occasionally end up having a binge and purge even through that period of time. And it was probably, and maybe it was even over a year, but there was a, it was a good period of time from starting the journey of recovery to actually going, wow, I haven't binged and purged now for X number of months, and being like, oh, wow, that was my, and then I, you know, being able to pinpoint that was the last time I did it and I haven't done it since. Yeah.
I think that's a really key thing to say, is that, you know, it won't disappear overnight, but also if you do binge and purge, that doesn't mean that you failed recovery or that you're back in the eating disorder or things have all gone to flop. You know, it's, that's perfectly okay, but I think it, from my perspective, it's always how you pick yourself back up and how quickly you can pick yourself back up to then continue with the journey. You know, I have instances and days or whatever where I might restrict and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh no, this isn't what we do anymore. How do we get back on track? Like, what coping mechanisms can we bring in? Or kind of looking outside at life and saying, you know, what's going on here that means that I'm feeling pulled back into these behaviours?
And with my clients, we call it a learning event. So we learn, so that happened. Let's move on. What can we learn from it? And you're right, like, what could you do in future if that happens again? Are there coping mechanisms that you could put in place that would either help you not get into that position in the first place, or if it did happen, what can you do after to sort of, you know, soften the blow, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. And bringing in that compassion for yourself as well, to say, you're not a bad person because you've done this. But I wanted to also talk to you about kind of that stage that you were talking about in terms of like quasi-recovery and that mental restriction, because I think that is definitely a place that people get stuck in, because it's almost like I can live like this, you know, I can have the cake, but I'm rigid about how much cake I'm having, or, you know, if I'm having the cake then I'm not having something else. So how was that for you? What impact did that have on your life?
Well, to be honest, I didn't, at the time I didn't see it as having any impact. I think because I was you know, I was eating everything I wanted to eat. So sort of, you know, all foods fit. But when I look back, I was very concerned. I know that I was very concerned about weight gain. So, you know, I was making sure that I was, you know, it's the classic thing. I was exercising then in order to not gain weight. So it wasn't because it made me feel good, or so I would, you know, do some really hardcore exercise that probably made me feel worse, but I was doing it because I was so desperate not to gain weight. And I was eating in a way that was, meant that mental restriction of like, goodness, I've had a slice of cake at someone's birthday. That means I need to really chill out the next few days and not have anything like that. So there was, I guess, although they weren't such rigid rules, there were definitely mental rules in place. But I think from the outside, no one would think that I had any issue with food, which compared to how I had been, things were so much better. But then I also think, because I also got married in that period of time, and I ended up losing a fair amount of weight for the wedding, as sadly a lot of brides do. But again, I was also like, I was like, I'm not dieting, but I was following a kind of quote unquote healthy eating plan, which really was a diet, but I was convincing myself and everyone else that I was just eating healthily for the wedding. So it's kind of, you spot these behaviors and stuff in hindsight, because I was fully convinced that I was completely recovered, and I was so adamant that I would never diet again because of what had happened with bulimia. But then when I look back on that period of time, there was definitely, it was a diet. It's no denying it. I was dieting for about a year then. And I think, again, also, this is what you're saying about normalizing things. A lot of my friends were getting married in that period of time, and everyone was doing something similar, even though we may not have been calling it a wedding diet. We were definitely like, oh, get into my best shape, or, you know, we were all exercising and eating in a way in order to lose weight, basically, even though that's not what we were saying. We're saying we want to look good on the day, or whatever words we were using. But essentially, it was a diet in disguise.
Yeah.
And then I would say exactly the same for all the orthorexic stuff as well. It's basically, a diet in disguise.
And I think that's what worries me now. It obviously, eating disorders worry me, but I think that we're hopefully becoming more and more aware of eating disorders and having more conversations. Mm. It's the sort of diet in disguise that, you know, you can live your life doing that, but it takes so much away from your life. And it's definitely the place I'm in at the moment, in terms of that, like, I'm in recovery, doing really well in recovery, but there's still rules that I know exist. But to Joe Blogs on the street, it doesn't look, because you've got that experience of how you used to be, it doesn't look nearly as bad. And I think it's so difficult with things like, you know, when you're going to get married, going on holiday, just after having a baby, it's so normalized to engage in those behaviors. And you can, it's like you say, the language around it is, it's so easy to say, you know, I just want to look good, I just want to feel at my best, like, I just want my dress to look nice and stuff. But all of that goes back to the connotation that you're saying, you have to be smaller in order to feel all of those things. And especially if all your friends are doing it around you, why would you even question? Well, one, why would you question to do it? But also, on the other hand, the pressure to do it. Because if you're, let's say, going out for lunch with all your friends that are getting married, and you're not dieting, but they are, it's then kind of that pressure of, oh, well, they're all doing it, so I should be doing it. It's almost, I remember saying to my mum a few years back, like, you know, I would never go on a diet when I was going to get married because of my history. And, you know, she's very aware of what I've been through. And she just kind of said, yeah, but it's what everybody does. That's the normal thing to do. Not to pressure me to do it, but she was saying from her perspective, when she got married, she was very similar. She went on a diet and lost a lot of weight. And I remember I don't remember because I wasn't there, but apparently one of her friends, they were having dinner together and they were going to get dessert. And my mum said that she didn't want one. And her friend just said to her, I think you've got to a point where this needs to stop now. And that was for her the point that she was like, oh shit, things are maybe getting, you know, more than just a diet for my wedding. Which thank God she had an honest friend that could say that. But it's the same, I think, with, you know, like what you were saying about after having a baby, people don't question it.
Yeah. The pressure is actually unbelievable. I think it's almost worse than getting when you get married,
really,
because I think there's this sort of, there's this expectation, like everyone says, you'll get your body back, because everyone's like 9 months up, 9 months down, so the expectation is that you should get your body back, which is, there's so much more pressure there, because you've just carried a baby, you've just grown a human being inside your body, and probably you've been breastfeeding as well. And I mean, I think about my poor daughter, I was restricting while I was breastfeeding her because I was following all these wellness trends. And no wonder, and then you get really exhausted and you're finding motherhood extremely tiring. Well, of course you are, because you're not feeding yourself properly. And I look back at pictures of me 6 months after I'd given birth to her, and I'm probably the smallest I've ever been. And I think, what had I done to myself for that to happen? It's shocking. It's so shocking. But the pressure is, and you go, like, I was going to sort of postnatal yoga and postnatal this and postnatal that. And even the people who are running these classes are saying, you know, let's get you ready for next summer. Let's get you bikini ready. Let's get you ready for your holiday. And so that it comes, you know, there's societal pressure. Mm-hmm. There's the pressure on social media. Then you hear about all these celebs who, you know, oh my God, I was reading stuff in whatever, in magazines or on social media about, oh, so-and-so got into her size X jeans after, you know, 2 months or whatever. So you're like, oh wow, she got into her pre-baby jeans after 2 months. And then you have friends saying that to you. They're like, oh, I was wearing these jeans, you know, 3 months before I got pregnant. And you're like, what, how did you do that? So there's like, whether it's conversations you have with friends, whether it's people who are running postnatal classes, whether it's stuff you're reading about in the news, it's just like the media influence and societal influence about this expectation that you should get your body back. It's real pressure. And I think I felt even more pressure then. And also because I knew I didn't want any more babies. So I hadn't felt the pressure after my son, he's now 12. I didn't feel much pressure with him because I was like, well, I'm going to have another baby. So there's no point in, you know, slogging my guts out to get slim again, you know, whatever. But with Xanthi, I felt that pressure. I was like, right now's the time. And also everyone says it. So all your friends who've had all the babies that they're going to have, they're like, right now, time to get the body back. Mm. Oh, so
which is so hard, isn't it? Because, you know, you could say there, oh, for God's sake, they've been through it, surely they understand. But they are probably, that's an indication of the pressure that's put on them as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that makes it even harder. But I think the thing that gets me is, one, you know, when you look at the celebrities, they're celebrities, they probably got like personalized nutritionists, coaches, mm-hmm. nannies, you know, all of that mm-hmm. they can quote unquote bounce back because they've got the money to do so.
Yeah,
but I think it's so, what frustrates me about society is you're told, oh, you need to bounce back, but if you're not able to deal with the pressure, then you're a shit mum. You know, if you're not spending every second with your child, you're a shit mum. So I think it's really important that as a new mum, or, you know, a mum in general, you have that time for yourself, whether that is going out for, you know, a coffee, catch up mm-hmm. with your friends, a yoga class, going to the gym for an hour or whatever. You need to have that space because your life's gone from not having a baby in your life to 24/7 you're now caring for mm-hmm. this thing that's just appeared.
Exactly.
But when you have that time to yourself, you're then called a shit mum. And, you know, if they could see the kind of extent you have to go to bounce back from that, what's just happened, you're not going to form that connection with your child, because at the end of the day, you're going to resent them for then putting you in the position that you now are. So it's awful. And yeah, genuinely, it almost puts me off having children.
It's the pressure, and like you say, I think as a mom, it's like whatever choice you make, there's going to be someone who's like, oh, I can't believe you did that, because it's so much better if you do X. So, you know, the whole breastfeeding, bottle feeding, or going back to work, not going back to work, or working part time, whatever it is, going out in an evening, leaving your kid at home when they're 3 months old, like whatever decision you make, there's someone who will criticize it and be like, I can't believe you did that. Just like, oh, for God's sake, we can't win.
Well, we can't, can we? And I think that's the important thing about really staying in your own lane and doing
totally
what is right for you. You know, you knew that going on a diet wasn't the right thing for you, but unfortunately it crept in. And I guess talking about things creeping in, I did want to talk to you about sort of your experience of orthorexia and wellness and stuff, because I think it's another thing that is absolutely on the rise, especially with the disguise of wellness and health.
Yeah.
So how did that all come about for you?
Do you know, I actually just think it's so insidious, actually, wellness culture, because it's presented as this really positive thing. Mm-hmm. So it's about, you know, taking health into your own hands. You can be the healthiest version of you just so long as you eat these foods and you do this kind of movement or exercise or whatever. But essentially it's just diet culture wrapped up in a different package. But I almost think it is more insidious because it's less obvious. And I think the things, you know, I think that sucked me in, the idea of being the healthiest version of me, especially because I knew I didn't want to diet, even though I ended up dieting even harder than I'd ever dieted in my whole life. But there's just everything about it. I think it uses a lot of pseudoscience, and with a sort of psychology background, there's part of me that thinks, why didn't I realize that it was just a pack of lies? But then the other part of me is like, well, I was probably quite vulnerable at that point in my life, given where I was and the previous sort of eating disorder history. I was probably the classic person who is lured into wellness culture. And I think there's enough pseudoscience to make it sound credible. And you've got enough scientific looking / sounding people in the space saying things that you think, oh yeah, that's great. And so you've got loads of sort of social media and like toxic influencers. I can't remember what he's called. There's some guy that I follow on Instagram, and he calls them influencers, which I just think they are. Not influencers, influencers. It's so good, isn't it? But they're kind of, it's all about clean eating and toxic free. And you've got, whether it's people in media or social media influencers, telling you that this is the best way to achieve perfect health. And then I think that there's also all this kind of moralistic talk around food, this kind of, it's toxic or clean, or it's healthy, unhealthy, or it's going to help you live longer. All the BS marketing that they use. And I think I just fell for it. I really did. I think I was just in that stage of thinking, because I didn't want to diet, outright diet, it just felt like that kind of good option.
Yeah. And I don't think you're alone in that in the slightest, because at the end of the day, whoever started this, best marketing in the whole entire world, like clever.
Brilliant marketing.
Clever, yeah. Person, because it's not labelled as a diet. It's labelled as optimising health and, you know, like you said, maximising your health and being the healthiest you possibly can. So that's, I think, why people get drawn in, because the kind of overarching focus is you're going to be really healthy from this. This is really good from your health. Scaremongering you into thinking if you eat X, Y, and Z, that's going to be bad for your health. What we all know but won't admit is that the underlying factor is weight loss or weight maintenance. Yeah. Like, you know, every single thing that you are discussing, you might say, oh, I'm not going to eat that because it's bad for my cholesterol or la, la, la. But on the bottom line, it is all about weight. And I think that's what's scary, because you're not kind of going, oh, I'm on a diet. Because if I turned around and said, you know, oh, I'm not eating X because I'm on a diet, I think everyone would be like, kind of, come on, like, it's fine. Yeah. But if I say, oh, I'm not eating X, Y, and Z because some person said that that's bad for my health, people don't question it. And also, you know, with things like orthorexia, there's such a hype at the moment for like superfoods and healthy foods. And actually, like you said, there's such a moral compass about it. If I go out with friends and I choose the kale, lentil, bulgur wheat kind of salad with, you know, some sort of dressing and high protein, la, 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 nobody's questioning it, because at the end of the day, I'm having a balanced meal. And if I just sat and ordered lettuce, they'd probably be like, what the hell's going on? But actually, when I look at the menu and that high protein superfood salad is there, I don't feel like I can choose the burger and chips, because that is not a health, quote unquote, healthy option to choose. And I think that's the problem, is that we've got this idea now and we feel so much guilt when we do eat foods that aren't quote unquote good for our health. But it's, yeah, it's scary.
And I think the thing that worries me about wellness culture is it's focused health down to you, what you personally do. So it puts the onus on you 100%. And it's about how, what you eat, how you eat, and how you exercise. And it forgets, and I think the one thing that I completely lost when I was in, especially in the depths of orthorexia, is the social element of health. Like I stopped going out, I stopped hanging out with friends, I stopped having a glass of wine, I stopped like relaxing, like loosening the reins, enjoying myself. And so whilst I was doing everything to control what I was eating and make sure that I was doing like loads of really high intensity interval training, because that was supposedly best for my health, but I stopped hanging out with friends, and my mental health took a massive dive because I was so like it was all about control, like controlling this and restriction and fooling myself into thinking that I was doing all the right things. But then here I am, like avoiding social occasions, stressing out actually when I had to go to something that was like, I don't know, someone's birthday, or like being invited to dinner was like the worst thing for me because I'd be super embarrassed about saying, yeah, I'm afraid I'm off this and that and this and that. And, you know, when people politely say, is there anything you're not, you know, that you don't eat? Thinking that you might say, well, we don't eat mushrooms or something, whatever it is. You've got like this huge long list of almost virtually everything, every food group. And I had people say, I'm really struggling with what to feed you. That's so embarrassing. Yeah. So like, yeah, so the mental health side and the social health. And then also I think the wellness culture, the other massively insidious thing is that in order to eat in a way that is aspirational from wellness culture side, you need money. Mm-hmm. So it totally denies the fact that your socioeconomic status and access to good food and education and, you know, decent whatever hospital and GP is actually a massive indicator of health as well. So it's just so insidious, and I see it seeping into so many things. It's all over social media. I have conversations with some of my clients and they're like, oh, I saw this person on, you know, TikTok or Instagram, and they were saying that I shouldn't eat bread, bought bread from the supermarket. Is that right? And I'm like, no, ignore it. Please unfollow. Let's talk about this. Because, you know, even in, you know, binge eating or bulimia recovery, chatting to me, they're still worrying about, you know, you've got the influencers telling them not to eat or drink or whatever it is, this, that and the other. It's just it's hard, I think, and I think it's just everywhere as well, absolutely everywhere. And I think also the other thing is that I see people who think they're not part of it but are also part of it as well on social media. So they'll be like, oh, we don't believe in diets, we don't believe in restricting food, but the thing that we say that you should do is gluten-free and dairy-free and this, that free and that free. And I'm like, those two things don't they don't work together, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's the kind of it goes back to the whole thing of like, you know, it's not a diet but it is a diet. And I think, you know, I used to think, oh, you know, when people are saying like you should go gluten-free because of X, Y, and Z, or dairy-free because of X, Y, and Z, I used to be like, you know, it's probably just, it's really difficult on social media now if you don't have the, if you're not able to go and do your own research to then kind of know what's right and what's wrong. But I don't think that's even the case anymore, because as somebody that I have a nutrition degree, you know, I have a good education behind me, I'm still, you know, I see someone say don't eat bread, or, you know, you shouldn't have X, Y, and Z, I'm still questioning it, because it's, I don't know actually what it is, but there's something behind it all that, you know, if somebody says this food is bad, you do then think, oh God, is it bad? And especially when it's somebody, an influencer that has a body type that you aspire to, you're like, oh, well, they've cut out blah, 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 so I should probably do that. So then I end up looking like them. And I think that is dangerous and really scary. And people have a role, particularly when they do have such a big following. But what you were saying as well about kind of, I guess, wealth and also mental health, I think they're two things that we often forget about. And prior, you know, when I was going through my relapse and stuff, I thought that recovery would just mean that I could go out for dinner and eat a pizza sort of thing. But I forgot about all the other things that I was restricting in my life. And it's so nice now to, like you say, go to a friend's house and then just cook me dinner. And me not say, you know, because it's, and I think this is the other thing about kind of wellness and health, is you almost don't feel worried to say, oh, I can't have this and I can't have that, because it's almost normalized, like, you know, you can't have those foods because they're not healthy. But when I was in my eating disorder, someone would say, oh, what foods don't you eat? And I'd be like, what foods do I eat? But I didn't feel like I could say that, because I was like, I have this is an eating disorder and I don't want to admit that. So I'd just then have like a week's worth of anxiety stressing about what food we were going to eat. But I didn't feel like I could explain it. Whereas I think that's the difference with sort of the wellness and health. It's like, I don't have, you know, X, Y, and Z because of health. And it feels very different to, I don't eat it because I have a fear of it as an eating disorder. But actually, when you come down to it, you have a fear of it because
it legitimizes it, doesn't it? Yeah. Because it makes it totally legitimate that you can go to someone's house and say, here's a list of the things I'm not eating because they are not good for my health, versus, you know, what you were saying about stressing about going. Am I equally stressed about going to people's houses? Like, what are they going to feed me? It's going to be on my not allowed list. I can't possibly eat it.
Absolutely. And actually now, you know, the best feeling in the world is not, but for example, last night I went out for a date night with my partner, and the food that we had was lovely, and it was great to, you know, I really enjoyed the food that we had, but the best part about the evening wasn't the food that I ate. The best part of the evening was I didn't spend the whole day checking the menu as to what I was going to eat. I then didn't spend the whole activity before food thinking about what we were going to eat. We literally looked at the menu and I was like, oh, shall we share this and this? Because now I love sharing food with my partner, and that is an element of connection that we just couldn't have before. Definitely. And we ate it, and we were just chatting as we were eating. And it was so incredibly nice to just not have the food as the focus. But when
you're totally right.
But when you're like engaged in wellness and health and things like that, you can't have that freedom, because you have to make sure you go to a restaurant that has something that you're going to be able to eat. Then you worry about it. You spend the whole day worrying about it.
It's the headspace that frees up afterwards, isn't it? Because you're no longer consumed with food thoughts. It's honestly, it's life changing. I think that's what I would say about food freedom for me. It changed my life, like literally changed my life.
Yeah. And I guess just to kind of finish the episode here, it sounds amazing and it is amazing. But when there is so much talk about how you should eat and what's healthy and things like that, what would be your best advice for people thinking, I want to get to that, but the noise around what I should eat is just so loud, I don't know how to shut that out?
Oh. Unfollow a ton of people on social media. I mean, this is one thing I always say to my clients, is if there are people on social media that you're following at the moment that make you either feel bad about your body or bad about what you're eating or guilty about what you're eating, then unfollow them. And I think the ironic thing about, you know, even sort of recovery and what is quote unquote normal eating, is that it is literally that all foods fit approach. So being able to eat anything without guilt or without worrying beforehand or after, but in a way that feels like really relaxed and like we were just talking about, like freeing up headspace is the huge thing. And so if you're following people on social media that make you feel bad about what you're eating or how your body looks, or making you feel compelled to try something to change your behavior or change the way you look, then unfollow. This is what I always say, is like, that's the only detox I'm for, a social media detox.
I love
all
that.
About social media, yeah. Detox.
Absolutely. Have a social media cleanse. Exactly. I think that's a really good point. And I think it's about, sometimes you can be so warped into it that you don't even realize, but sometimes just taking a step back and thinking about, you know, what are the sort of impacts of the behaviors that I'm engaging in, you know, is this having a negative impact on me? And, you know, I think social media is such a big one, because it is just kind of scrolling and mindlessly scrolling often, you absorb that information without even realizing. And sometimes I'll go on my discovery feed and it's all like high protein, low carb recipes. And I'm like, I know, I think this is a sign that you've been looking at some of the wrong things, because why is your discovery feed all of this now?
Yeah.
And you can get kind of consumed by that and think, okay, well, I definitely should be making a ninja creamy high protein ice cream rather than having Ben and Jerry's. But
yeah,
why? Why do you think that? So Lara, thank you so much. I could talk to you so much longer. Where can people go to find out more about you?
So best places to find me, I like hanging out on Instagram. So I'm Dr. Lara Zibb on Instagram. Come find me, come and say hello. And then my website is the same, drlarazibb.com. They can find me there.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. It's been absolutely lovely to talk to you. And thank you so much for sharing your experience.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me, Hannah. It's been lovely chatting to you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.